Other People's Flowers is a podcast for stories, poetry, and essays. Thank you for listening.
Claudia Hinds graduated from Harvard and received a master's degree in English from Southern Methodist University. She worked as a broadcast journalist for network affiliates in California, Seattle, and Dallas. Her articles, essays, book reviews, and fiction have appeared in The Manifestation, Brevity, The Boston Globe, International Herald Tribune, 1859 Oregon's Magazine, Flash Fiction Magazine, and Bend Lifestyle Magazine. Her first novel is out on submission with Writer's House.
To Honor a Hero. It is story time at the library on base at the Marine Corps Air Station Miramar, San Diego, home to the 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing, the 3rd MAW. A girl in a pink dress and sequined sneakers toddles after her mother into the children's room. They are greeted by the sing-songy voice of the librarian, who welcomes them into the circle. The base library is spick and span. The architecture is 70s style with a flat roof and concrete walls. On the display shelves, new hardbacks shine in plastic sheaves. The walls of the library are decorated with depictions of Marines and their aircraft. Marines bowing their heads in a sandstorm in Iraq. Marines in a village of Afghanistan conversing with elders. An Afghani man fingering prayer beads. Miramar's outreach officer, Second Lieutenant Frederick D. Walker, leads me into a conference room. He is courteous in a way that seems sadly out of fashion. In one day on base, I will be called ma'am more than I have in my entire life. Second Lieutenant Walker has arranged for me to meet with First Lieutenant David Guerin, a pilot with the Marine Heavy Helicopter Squadron 465, known as Warhorse. Lieutenant Guerin flies the CH-53E, the largest and most powerful helicopter in the world. He was a colleague and good friend of 27-year-old Captain Samuel Duran Phillips, who was killed along with the entire crew when their helicopter went down in a training exercise in the desert north of Miramar on April 3rd. Also killed in the crash were Captain Samuel A. Schultz, 28, of Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania, Gunnery Sergeant Derek R. Hawley, 33, of Dayton, Ohio, and Lance Corporal Taylor Conrad, 24, of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. A naval investigation is underway. No one will speak about the specifics of the crash. Lieutenant Guerin could be out of central casting with his high and tight haircut, shaved on the side, short on top. He wears the standard green utilities or camis, his dog tag snug in the laces of his boot. He looks to be in his mid to late 20s, not much older than my own son. It is a jarring realization. The majority of the Marines at Miramar are men, and a handful of women, in their 20s. A whole base of young people whose daily training involves risks that I have never once in my 50 years faced. Lieutenant Guerin does not ask why I'm here. All he knows is that I want to write a story about Captain Samuel Duran Phillips, a man I've never met, who grew up in my small town in Oregon and graduated from the same high school my 3 children attended. "I really miss Sam a lot," Lieutenant Guerin says. "He was one of the most gentle people you could ever know." A civilian employee tiptoes into the room to retrieve boxes. Before she closes the door behind her, I hear the children's librarian singing in the adjacent room. Lieutenant Guerin grasps the black bracelet on his wrist. It is a remembrance bracelet engraved with Captain Phillips' name and those of the 3 other Marines who were killed. Lieutenant Guerin was not scheduled to fly the day Captain Phillips and his crew were killed. Instead, Guerin was back on base. He took the call that the CH-53E helicopter went down. It was his job to call in fire and rescue teams. His eyes cut away from me. He shakes his head and swallows. "I'd been to that area," he says. That area is the desert near the Naval Air Facility near El Centro, California, where many military training exercises take place because the austere conditions mimic the challenging improvised landings Marines may be forced to make in combat zones. I ask Lieutenant Guerin if he hesitated to fly after the crash. He pauses and then says no. I ask if his friend's death has changed him. "Yes," he finally answers. "It created a desire in me to be better at my job. It added fuel to the fire." Guerin says Sam was a good pilot, smooth on the controls. He was a relentlessly hard worker, consistently staying late to plan flights, arriving early to review the flight plan, and double-checking every detail. He was also super smart, a quick study of new syllabuses for pilot qualifications. Garen says Sam would have made a great instructor because he was passionate about teaching and loved teaching Marines. In spite of what I've heard about the exhaustive preparations before every flight, no matter how routine, I am curious whether Lieutenant Garen will concede to some failure, human or mechanical. "Do you do anything differently now before going up in the air?" I ask him. "Yes," he says. He pauses again. "I make sure I leave my family the right way." He says he can't discipline his son before he walks out the door. Every time he says goodbye, he tells his family, "I love you, and I'll be home soon." He looks away again. You can't take for granted the life that you have. You have to get your ducks in a row in case something happens to you. Like most pilots in the Marines, Captain Phillips attended officer candidate school after college. He graduated from the University of Idaho and commissioned with the Corps. After officer candidate school and then flight school, Captain Phillips chose to specialize in the CH-53E, continuing on to additional training specific to the aircraft. On Miramar's base are F-18 fighter jets, C-130s, enormous carriers which trundle as if in slow motion through the sky, MV-22 Ospreys, a hybrid-looking tilt-rotor aircraft with the versatility of a plane's fixed wings and the flexibility of taking off and landing on a dime like a traditional helicopter, and finally the CH-53E, the super stallion of the sky. The flight line and hangars housing these aircraft line the southern border of Miramar. The base is much like one sees in movies, a little city unto itself, although not nearly as big as nearby Pendleton, which is home to 70,000 military and civilian personnel. Military police guard the entrances to Miramar's base, and there is a steady stream of cars coming and going. Many are civilians employed by the Department of Defense. There is a grocery store, commissary, for former and active military personnel and their families, retail stores known as the PX or Post Exchange, medical clinics, online learning centers for Marines working toward a degree, playgrounds, a sports bar, gyms, Dunkin' Donuts, a Taco Bell, and a Starbucks under construction. Unlike Pendleton, most Marines of the 3rd MA and their families live off base, but there is a small complex of barracks which, from the outside, resemble college dorms. Marines in different uniforms jog on sidewalks outside the flight line, which is lined with concertina wire. Today, F-18s are parked on the flight line. President Trump stood in front of these fighter jets back in March and addressed the troops of Miramar, promising to replace the aging fleet of Super Stallions and introduce new weaponry that had never been seen before. Outside the officers' quarters, a flag with 3 stars alerts everyone that a 3-star general is on base. A Marine's rank is fundamental to every exchange. Officers are addressed by the enlisted as sir or ma'am and typically saluted. As Marines approach us, my escort, Second Lieutenant Walker, is checking Marines' uniforms to identify their rank and look for the shine of the enlisted service personnel's stripes. "Rah, Lance Corporal," he says when an enlisted Marine with the rank of Lance Corporal passes. "Rah" is short for oorah, the Marine greeting. To the more senior executive officer of 465, he says, "Ma'am." We pass through security checkpoints and enter the building of the HMH 465. The men and the one female, the executive officer, wear green flight suits with the symbol of their squadron warhorse on a badge on their right breast. When we head out to the hangar, I'm instructed not to report how many 53s are associated with the 456 squadron. It's a matter of operational security. But suffice it to say, there are more than a few. I had watched videos of the CH-53E on YouTube, but it isn't until I am standing next to the Super Stallion that I realize how massive it is. It would more appropriately be called the Beast. It is hard to imagine how it gets off the ground, never mind lugs 32,000 pounds of cargo, 55 Marines, artillery, even tanks. The aircraft is 100 feet long and weighs more than 33,000 pounds. It is designed for combat assault support, meaning weapons can be affixed at the rear, but its main purposes are to bring in supplies, artillery, troops, and get Marines out. The Third MA did all of these things during Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2002 in their support of the 1st Marine Division. Crew members say the 53 is all about the guys on the ground. Typically, this helicopter has a crew of four, including two pilots, one the commander, the other the co-pilot. Two Marines in the back serve a variety of purposes, acting as aerial observers, sighting the ground and hazards out the open window. The Super Stallion is so big that in spite of sophisticated instrumentation, Marines are needed along the side and back of the cabin to assist the pilots in eyeballing the terrain and situation out the window. The enormity and heft of the CH-53E present a whole host of challenges to fly, not to mention the precise execution of landings and takeoffs in austere conditions. Every crew member has to rely 100% on a high level of training. When I asked Lieutenant Guerin why he chose to fly this particular aircraft, he described a crew mentality. You have to trust the people in the back, and the guys in the back have to trust the guys up front. This dependence on a fellow Marine is not so different from other core jobs, in which only the most rigorous and grueling training prepares a Marine for war, instilling faith that every Marine has each other's back. Preparing the 53 for battle requires rehearsing different flight patterns and training for a variety of landing scenarios. The training, no matter how routine, is inherently dangerous, and yet, as Lieutenant Guerin notes, it builds safety by mitigating risk in the future. If we didn't do this stuff all the time, he says, we wouldn't be ready. The ready room is where I meet First Lieutenant Jason Burns, who was the schedule writer with Captain Phillips on his last flight. Schedule writers take the flight plan, which was designed in weekly meetings, and then review every single detail regarding the assigned crew and the aircraft itself. It is an extensive and exhaustive sounding process for making sure that each person on board has the proper qualifications for that particular flight's training exercise, to confirming that every safety feature has been reviewed and re-reviewed. A pilot or crew member who is congested or was up all night with a newborn could be sent home at the last minute, the flight canceled. Every single precaution is taken, every risk assessed, and yet, as Lieutenant Guerin quotes the Navy saying, if safety was the number one priority, no plane would ever leave the ground. Risk is inherent, and while it is assiduously assessed and minimized, it is always, always present. Lieutenant Burns says Sam was a solid pilot who was fastidious about details. He was tough on himself and would beat himself up if every single aspect of a flight didn't go perfectly. And yet off-duty, Sam was lighthearted and easygoing. Everyone loved him, Lieutenant Burns says. He was teaching Sam to surf, and while they didn't get much time off, he and Sam were really taking to the sport. Mostly, he says, they just played around in the white water while Sam got the hang of standing up on the board. Burns fingers the black remembrance bracelet on his wrist. I had to remind him not to look back at me when he got up on the board, Burns says, smiling. Sam was always turning around for approval, always with a huge grin on his face. Leaving base is a strange sensation. Within 1,000 meters, I am back in the civilian world, but it feels like a whole other country. The vegetation is, of course, the same. Rows of palm trees bend in the dim light of low cloud cover. Second Lieutenant Walker takes me to a Denny's, where I will wait for an Uber ride. He hurries around the truck to open the door for me and thanks me for my time. A few minutes later, an Uber driver picks me up. He does not get out of the car to open my door or call me ma'am. He has a strong accent, and when I ask, he explains he is originally from Pretoria, South Africa. He makes a lot of money driving Uber and loves the freedom of working whenever he wants and not driving when he'd rather chill with his girlfriend. Of the two Uber and one taxi driver on my 24-hour visit to San Diego, all three are immigrants, one from Ethiopia and the other from Ukraine. Each of them says the same thing in nearly the same words. America is the greatest country in the world. The oldest of these drivers, an immigrant from Ethiopia, has been in San Diego for 27 years. He has never set foot on base, although he has driven along the perimeter countless times over the decades. Like other neighbors of Miramar's Third MA, he may look up when he hears the F-18's deafening roar or the Super Stallion lumbering off to the desert to practice landings on unimproved land, like the spot where Captain Phillips and his crew crashed. Civilians live side by side with the servicemen and women of the base, and yet there is little, if any, intersection between these worlds. Back in downtown San Diego, the news is all about the NFL decision to fine players who refuse to kneel during the national anthem. Sitting down for dinner in the Gaslamp District, I look through my notes of my day on base. Behind me, a noisy table clinks glasses, and I turn around to see them throw back shots. It is happy hour, and I assume that they are colleagues glad to escape the office. They seem to be celebrating. One woman stands and dumps a handful of plastic bracelets in the middle of the table. They are rainbow-colored. The other people wiggle their hands through the bracelets while the gift-giver explains why she chose them. "I got one for my son, too," she says, explaining that there is a blessing that goes along with them. "You are precious, you are loved, you are blessed." The guy to her left says, "Aw," before planting a kiss on her cheek. I look out the window in time to see a woman on a scooter crossing the intersection. A giant tote bag printed with the American flag hangs from her wrist. I am aware of my hand circling my own wrist. I would have liked to ask for a memorial bracelet in honor of the crew that were killed. Not that I deserve to wear a bracelet of the Marines. I've never served in the military. No one in my immediate family has served. I've never even met Captain Phillips, although I'd like to think that I crossed paths with him at some point in our small town. I have friends who grieve for him, coaches, parents, and their grown children who loved him and remember him as a standout athlete, the ideal teammate, and the nicest guy. When I learned of Captain Phillips' death, I tried unsuccessfully to get the flags in our town lowered to half staff in his honor. I thought there should be some physical reminder of him and who he was, how he chose to live his life, how he was willing to die in service to our country. It's why I'd like a bracelet, why I'd like everyone in our small town to wear a bracelet with Sam's name on it, to remember what we owe Sam and his crew, what we owe the Marines who this very minute are going up in the Super Stallion. When I go onto the 3rd MOS Twitter page, I see the photos of troops returning from a 6-month deployment in Japan. On the tarmac, Marines in green flight suits squat with arms outstretched as their children race into them. There is a photo of 2 children holding a poster with small handprints in red and blue. It reads, "These are the hands that prayed for your safe return." And for those who do not return safely from deployment, from a war zone or a training exercise in the desert, what are, as Woodrow Wilson asked in the cemetery of Suresnes, France, the unspoken mandates of our dead? What is our part, our due to the men and women who risk everything, who put service to their country ahead of their own families every day? If we choose not to serve, what must we in turn do? Insist on improved health care and health care access for veterans and their families? Protest sending troops to wars we cannot win? Support organizations that work with combat veterans and their families who are coping with post-traumatic combat stress? Is any of this enough? Boarding the plane home, I wait behind a man in sand-colored fatigues. His backpack looks heavy. It is covered in badges that read Helmand Province, one with the bony jeer of a skeleton. When the soldier turns a little in my direction, I say, "Thank you for your service." And without missing a beat, as if he's had this exchange many times, he says, "Thank you for your support." I think about the mother of the little girl in sequin sneakers back in the library on base. She must have been a wife of a Marine. I wish I had thanked her, although I don't know what words I might have chosen to acknowledge her sacrifices, her willingness to endure the uncertainty and worry every time her husband goes up in the air. I wonder if she knows the smell of the 53's cockpit, if she's seen the rosy glow of hydraulic fluid on the cabin floor, the chipped leather on the pilot seats, the stretchers folded up on the side of the cabin. I wonder what it feels like every time her husband walks out the door, every time he hugs them goodbye. Back at home, the news is rife with debate over the NFL's policy on kneeling for the anthem. My Twitter feed consists of thoughtful comments, some from veterans about how they fought to defend our freedom of expression and support athletes' choices to take a knee. And yet I'm left feeling that the gestures of professional athletes are inadequate. While their protests may be an important expression of our constitutional rights, they do not presage real or significant action. There are other outraged voices on Twitter, but even the most compelling and well-articulated arguments are merely performative, and we scroll on, scrolling on, ever on. There is a black and white photo of Sam in the obituary that ran in our local paper. He looks different to me now. I still don't know the color of his eyes. Lieutenant Burns said that Sam didn't like the cold of the Pacific and wore a wetsuit when he surfed. I picture him sleek in his black suit, smiling back at his buddy, the sun glittering in his eye. I picture him now just above the cloud cover, in the terrain where the super stallion lumbers by, rehearsing a mission to help. I think of the two bracelets, the Marines in metal and the civilians in plastic. I wonder whether any words are enough to honor a hero. Rest in peace, Sam. You are precious. You are loved. And now we are the ones who are blessed to act.
Thank you for listening to Other People's Flowers. Other People's Flowers is produced and edited by Hugo Gibson and Chris Kamonvutitam. If you enjoy the show, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. If you'd like to have your work featured on the program, please visit otherpeoplesflowers.com to see our submission guideline. Thank you.